intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello and good evening. This is Don Swans, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 2nd issue of the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Front page. The growing divide in the Rainbow Coalition. More gay people are speaking out against the gender ideology of trans and queer activists. It's written by Pamela Paul. As a very, very effeminate boy growing up in Baltimore, Ben Apple was teased mercilessly. At school, where he was regularly bullied, the other kids called him Ben Gay. It was awful, Apple, now 42 and married to another man, recalled. I realized I wasn't going to survive, so I made it my full-time job to determine myself as a form of self-protection. In his 20s, Apple lobbied for gay marriage, and in 2017, he interned at GLAAD, an LGBTQ advocacy group, determined to fight on behalf of kids like him. But later, when Apple enrolled at Columbia University, eager to learn about the theories behind his activism, the rhetoric encountered felt more like dogma than inquiry. According to queer theory, if you're a man who behaves in unmasculine ways or wears eyeliner, you must be a woman inside, which I thought was regressive. Apple, who graduated in 2020, recalled saying that those superficial attributes are what make women women, and that any variation on the rough he-man stereotype means you're not a man, reinforces those rigid sex roles, and I thought we were supposed to be against those. In his book, CI's White Gay, The Making of a Gender Heretic, which comes out next week, Apple argues that gender ideology is illiberal, regressive, and anti-gay, as much a cult as Lambs of God, the fundamental sect in which Apple was raised, and one that he and an increasingly vocal group of gay men, lesbians, and bisexual people reject. More than three dozen in-depth interviews with gay men, lesbian women, bisexuals, and transgender people, along with surveys and several new books, including The End of the Gay Rights Revolution by Ronan McRae, also coming out next month, reveal a complicated and contentious relationship between the LGB and TQ plus components of what advocacy organizations and the Democratic Party refer to as LGBTQ plus people. While gay and lesbian people emphasize that they oppose discrimination and harassment of transgender adults, they resent being force-teamed, taken over, or erased by trans and queer ideologues, especially when gay people can constitute 90% of those Gallup categories as LGBTQ+. In private chat groups and burgeoning LGB organizations and on podcasts, many questions whether same-sex attracted people should have allied themselves with trans and queer identities in the first place. To most LGBTQ and groups, this attitude is nothing short of trans exclusion, and antithetical to their principles. These disagreements stem from radically different ways of viewing identity. Gay people typically see their homosexuality as fundamentally grounded in biology and based on attraction to people of the same sex. Transgender people instead prioritize gender identity defined by the Human Rights Campaign, an LGBTQ plus advocacy group, as one's innermost concept of self as male, female, a blend of both, or neither. Meanwhile, queer theory argues that both sex and gender exist on a spectrum and are often fluid, allowing for labels like non-binary and genderqueer. There have always been fault lines within the Rainbow Coalition, but in the past 10 years, ever since the right to gay marriage was secured in 2015, further divisions have emerged and expanded, along with growing rancor and vitriol, all of which belies the overriding image of inclusion touted by advocacy groups. For those of us who work in this field as advocacy-focused political activists, these are hard conversations we have to have as a movement, said Kathy Rena, Communications Director for the National LGBTQ Task Force, founded in 1973 as the National Gay Task Force. To me, this is often about fear of the other, and nobody understands that better than queer people. As for gay people who don't believe in gender identity, Rena says, it's fine not to believe in it, but why do you have to impose what you believe on everybody else? Blow-ups regularly erupt over these conflicts. Pardon me. Blow-ups regularly erupt over these conflicts. In August, for example, John Boyne, author of the best-selling The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, was boycotted by more than 800 writers when his new novel, which addresses homophobia and sexual assault, was shortlisted for the Polari Prize, a literary award for gay British authors. Boyne had publicly stated that he supports transgender rights, except when they come into conflict with women's rights. For example, in prisons and domestic violence shelters. His fellow nominees removed themselves from contention in protest. The prize was canceled. And Polari vowed to increase the representation of trans and gender non-conforming judges on the panels. For LGBTQ advocates, solidarity has been the dominant strategy, one that often requires tamping down on conflicts, especially in the face of what most consider hostile rhetoric and policies from the Trump administration. In the aftermath of Trump's reelection, with its powerful Kamala Harris's For They/Them ad campaign, when the Democratic Congressman Seth Moulton voiced reservations about trans-identified girls playing on girls' sports teams, he was excoriated by LGBTQ groups for harmful speech, and one of his top staff members quit. Everyone is hell-bent on sticking together because they think there's strength and validation in numbers. But that's not true, says Ariel Scarsella, a 39-year-old Brooklyn-based YouTuber who frequently posts videos critiquing gender theory and trans activism to her 800,000 followers. I think there's safety in sanity because people can understand things that make sense. And none of this makes sense. You now have straight people calling themselves queer because they have a purple hair and are non-monogamous. To Jose Arango, immigrating to America at 17, after growing up in conservative, religious, homophobic Colombia, felt like a hibernation, a liberation, pardon me, felt like a liberation. I threw myself into everything gay, said Arango, now 27. He became president of the Pride Club at Miami-Dade Community College, Wolfson campus. He was awarded an LGBT scholarship from the Point Foundation. For the first time, he felt not only loved, but celebrated. He had found his community. Though confused by people using what seemed to him eccentric pronouns, he figured, I'm in this new country where things are more advanced. I didn't really question it. But the more he read about queer theory, the more Arango rejected the concept of gender identity. It was all based on stereotypes, he said, and anathema to gay kids like himself who were teased for not being manly enough. When Arango began expressing these views in 2022, his boyfriend dumped him and denounced him as a transphobe. He lost most of his friends. What he had originally understood as a welcoming LGBTQ plus community now felt exclusionary and hostile. There's a don't be ungrateful tone, especially aimed at gays who never knew a gay, who never knew a gay world before gender ideology took over. Arango explained, my view is that it's they who have betrayed us, insisting there are lesbians with penises and gay men with vaginas, and that any straight person calling themselves non-binary somehow belongs. Many gays and lesbians say gender identity strips same-sex attraction of its meaning. Transgender and queer activists have disappeared the idea of sex, and that means getting rid of the idea of sexual orientation and the whole basis of being gay. Suzanne Menashe, 72, a civil rights lawyer and lifelong gay rights activist based in San Diego. I'm on the far left, but this really is not progressive. In 2022, Menashe was fired from her job as Disability Rights California after objecting to the omission of the word women in a statement her employer put out in favor of abortion rights and speaking out about sex-based rights. I was called a bigot and a transphobe and such a danger to staff that I was refused employment. She said she filed a lawsuit and the matter was litigated and resolved out of court. Disability Rights California did not respond to requests for comment. Menashe was one of several interviewees who lost jobs for expressing similar views. What we're seeing is a witch hunt against lesbians, she said. For their part, trans advocates argued that trans women can also be lesbians, and that it is lesbians who are being exclusionary. Efforts to exclude trans women and non-binary people from lesbian and feminist communities are ahistorical, morally wrong, and go against the founding values of these movements. The National Center for LGBTQ Rights wrote in a statement issued during Lesbian Visibility Week. Barney Frank, the first openly gay member of Congress, has been in his fight for a long time. In 2007, he sponsored the End Discrimination Now Act, which would have ended workplace discrimination based on sexual orientation. He had enough Republican votes to pass it. But transgender activists excoriated him for not including gender identity as well. Frank added it to the bill, dooming it to failure. It would be another 13 years before both classes would win protection. Certain disagreements within the movement are substantive, Frank conceded in an interview. A lot of gay people don't buy into this notion that there's no such thing as a biological gender or support the insistence that male or to female transgender people should be granted entry to women's only spaces without clothing, Frank said. Despite recent polls showing waning support for gay marriage, Frank said he believes the real threat right now is toward transgender people. Most gay people, he said, support their basic rights, including official documents that reflect the person's gender identity and access to gender reassignment treatments for minors. But even what Frank refers to as basic rights are fiercely disputed. Every gay and lesbian person interviewed agreed that transgender people should be free from discrimination and harassment in housing and employment. as decided by the Supreme Court in the 2020 case, Postock v. Clayton County, which extended the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to sexual orientation and gender identity. But when it comes to altering the sex indicated on a birth certificate or passport, which 66% of Americans oppose, many raised objections. You can't undo the fact of how you were born or that you're male or female, said Adrian Geringer, 36, an investor in San Francisco and secretary for the LGB Alliance USA, a volunteer organization founded in 2020. It would be much harder to enforce single-sex spaces for women if you have no documentation to back it up, Geringer said. One viable alternative to changing a person's birth sex on official documents would be an additional gender identity category. For transgender people, it's not necessarily so simple. Brianna Wu, a 48-year-old Democratic operative, says the Trump administration's efforts to eliminate gender identity on passports would be a nightmare for people like her who have undergone gender reassignment surgery. The ideal was that if I did that, I got to be legally female, she said. Trump rolling that back has been a horrific attack on not just my civil rights, but also my dignity. For many gay people, the LGBTQ movement overwhelmingly support for pediatric gender transition is their biggest point of difference. They consider this a kind of conversion therapy akin to conservative efforts to treat gay youth by suppressing their sexual desires and becoming straight. Research shows the majority of kids seeking gender transition report same-sex attraction. In state houses from Georgia to California, some of the most vocal opponents to what proponents call gender affirmation caring for minors and gay and lesbian adults. They fear that America is inadvertently following the homophobic biases of countries like Iran, where homosexuality is illegal, and gay people are forced to choose between prison or gender transition. Naveen Enaj, a 35-year-old artist who blogs about race, gender, and creativity under the name N3VLNN, has lost friends and relationships as a result of her outspoken rejection of gender biology and her insistence on lesbian and sex-based rights. She also resents some LGBTQ advocates' comparisons of transgender oppression to racial oppression, which she sees as illogical. I have walked through fire, and I continue to walk through fire in my personal life, with friends saying, I can't hang out with you anymore because you said XYZ, or that they're afraid to be seen in my presence, Nanaji told me. In 2023, she lost the Instagram account she used as her professional platform after expressing support for Black lesbian detransitioners, formerly trans people who revert to their birth sex identity. Najee reported trying to have her account restored to no avail. A spokesman for Meta declined to comment, but pointed out that Meta's hate speech policy has since evolved. In January, the company lifted previous restrictions on topics that are part of mainstream discourse. For LGB dissenters, many of whom grew up closeted and relied on acceptance among their peers, being excoriated by their gay and lesbian communities is particularly painful. It runs against the outspoken activism that is often core to their identity. Many compared the way their own community treats them to being put back in the closet again. Two prominent organizations that advocate for trans rights, Lambda Legal and Trevor Project, that's Lambda, L-A-M-B-D-A, Legal, and the Trevor Project, did not respond to requests for interviews. Several gay people interviewed expressed hope that despite, or perhaps in response to, government headwinds, institutional intransigence and political polarization, speaking out may be getting easier. Recent data also suggests that after a decade of dramatic increases, fewer young people are identifying as trans or non-binary. Earlier this month, a widely circulated post on the Gender Crossroads Substack, quote, "A plea to my fellow trans people," unquote, declared the honeymoon phase for trans acceptance to be over. It read in part, "Part of me cannot help feeling that we as a community have brought some of this on ourselves by refusing to talk with people who hold different beliefs from our own. The no debate policy so common among trans activist circles. And by insisting that anyone who might have questions about the recent proliferation of gender identities is a transphobe." To say this one narrative is the true narrative, and anybody that says anything else is a bigot, is not a very helpful strategy. The Post author, Stefan, a 46-year-old trans man who transitioned in his 20s, said in an interview, "It doesn't really show much empathy for other people." You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review of November 2nd on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now changing direction, let's look at this article by Jonathan Cheng and Jason Douglas entitled, "The U.S. Thought a Trade War Would Change China. It Was Wrong." President Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping have walked back from the ledge again. But even as the world's two superpowers de-escalate a trade fight that had threatened to destabilize the global economy, a new reality is setting in that Washington may finally have to give up on its long-standing aim of pushing Beijing to restructure its economy. For years, and through successive U.S. administrations. Senior officials in Washington had hoped that bringing China into the global trading system would open up the country's political system. In the decades since China's accession to the World Trade Organization in 2001, those hopes of political liberalization have largely been dashed. The sense of disappointment has only grown as Chinese leader Xi Jinping, who took power in late 2012, has tightened his control of the domestic political system and civil society more broadly. Still, many in President Trump's circle of senior advisors had held out hope for China's economic liberalization. White House officials spoke of using America's economic might to move China away from what they regarded as a mercantilist trade policy that privileged exports, subsidized manufacturing, and discouraged its own 1.4 billion people from spending. U.S. strategists imagined that tariffs would squeeze efforts and encourage China to find new sources of growth at home, perhaps by overhauling its health and social welfare systems to allow consumers to spend more and save less. By pressuring Beijing to boost consumption, the idea went, China would start buying more goods from the U.S. and the rest of the world. Its trade surplus would shrink, and U.S. businesses and farmers would tap a consumer market of unparalleled potential. But while Trump's first term tariff, assault resulted in Chinese pledges to buy more American goods, it did not accomplish any of these larger structural aims. The Biden administration, though rhetorically committed to many of these broader economic liberalization goals, focused most of its efforts on constraining China's technological ambitions. This time around, Trump's sky-high tariffs have failed to move China. Unlike virtually every other trading partner hit with tariffs, Beijing retaliated with stiff countermeasures of its own, using its grip on rare earth metals to bludgeon American companies that rely on the critical minerals, while halting purchase of U.S. soybeans in a bid to punish America's agricultural sector. China's shock and awe approach left the two superpowers mired in months of a tactical tit-for-tat, resulting in dramatic displays of brinkmanship in Thursday's meeting between Trump and Xi, but leaving a big picture American concerns about China's economic structure unaddressed. Trade talks with China this time around are more focused on stabilizing the relationship versus advancing it by addressing structural matters, which appears to be a lost cause, says Wendy Cutler, former U.S. trade negotiator, now at the Asian Society Policy Institute in Washington. With the two sides bogged down in horse trading on tariffs and critical minerals, The structural matters have been entirely set aside. The reality is that de-escalation has become the objective of the trade talks with China, rather than breaking new ground, according to Cutler. Even today, some Chinese officials acknowledged that the country's consumption is too weak and nod to the desire for some rebalancing. Yet efforts have been piecemeal, stymied by an ideological attachment to industrial production as the wellspring of prosperity and the wariness of her painful reforms in taxation, healthcare, and social welfare needed to make a durable shift. When Trump was first elected in 2016, the U.S. adopted a more aggressive approach to force the issue, threatening a trade war that sought its part to change China's model. But rather than adopt the Western prescriptions, Beijing took advantage of Trump's exit from the Oval Office to instead make itself more impervious to pressures from Washington. Beijing systematically identified perceived choke points, that is, sectors where it was reliant on the U.S.-led West and worked to disarm Washington's points of leverage. China did this by building up domestic industries, developing alternative sources for scarce inputs, and carefully husbanding its strengths in areas where they saw a chance to seize control. More broadly, China has shifted its manufacturing model toward components and not just finished products, a change that has more deeply embedded the country in global supply chains, said Dinny McMahon, head of markets research at Trivium China, a research and consulting firm. Xi Jinping has been talking about that since at least 2019, strengthening global supply chains. McMahon said, now he says almost any manufactured good you buy, no matter where it comes from, has some exposure to Chinese supply chains. By finding ways to effectively hit back against the U.S., Xi forced Trump repeatedly onto the defensive, and in the process established China as a peer rival to the U.S., able to defy the world's longtime superpower on trade, technology, and increasingly geopolitics. The U.S. has a very little ability to influence China's macroeconomic strategy, said Oliver Melton, the director of China-focused consulting firm Rhodium Group. They have a different ideological understanding of what causes growth and economic development. Whether Beijing sticks to its current program of pursuing manufacturing and technological dominance at all costs will resonate far beyond China's shores. Already, Chinese import growth has stagnated, and its surplus in goods has ballooned to more than $1 trillion. China has refused to cede significant ground in lower-value manufacturing to less developed economies, even as it gains expertise in making cars, aircraft, chips, and other high-value goods. The result, said Eswar Prasad, a professor of trade policy at Cornell University and a former head of the IMF's China division, is that China is stifling manufacturing in other countries, whether they're poor, economies trying to nurture a domestic factory sector, or advanced economies facing a growing competitive threat. Trade barriers to Chinese goods are rising, and its own economy is menaced by deflation, the outgrowth of its rampant production. In the absence of aggressive reforms to restructure the economy, China's growth will slow while friction with its trade partners will increase, said Rhodium Melton, who recently wrapped up 5 years at the U.S. Treasury Department's financial attaché in Beijing. When Beijing released the blueprint for the next five-year plan earlier this month, it made clear it has little intention of deviating from a path that has, in Beijing's eyes, worked exceptionally well. Chinese leaders reemphasized their commitment to technological self-sufficiency, pledging to pour more investment into advanced manufacturing and boosting exports. If anything, the trade war has taught China the opposite of what the U.S. had hoped. Rather than prod Beijing to rebalance the economy, it showed Xi how essential it is for China to reduce its reliance on the U.S. in critical areas, such as semiconductors, and to develop economic weapons that allow it to hit back, such as its stranglehold on rare earths, said Henry Farrell, a professor of international affairs at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. That calls for more industry-led growth, not less. China's goal, Farrell said, is to maximize its freedom to do what it wants to do without the United States being capable of determining its destiny. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now, for a complete change of direction, there's a short column entitled About Face. It's a column about how someone changed their mind. This one is entitled, How I Learned to Turn Off My Stopwatch and Just Run. It's by Nicholas Thompson. Thompson is the CEO of The Atlantic and author of the new book, The Running Ground, A Father, A Son, in the Simplest of Sports, published this week by Random House. Written by Nicholas Thompson, he starts off by saying, I've always loved the mathematical precision of running. When I started the sport in high school, I'd plot out the exact time to the second that I hoped to run each lap. In my 20s and 30s, I started running marathons and charted my goals for each mile. One of the joys of running is how much you can control. You don't have teammates, a racket, or a ball. It's usually just you and a clock. Then in August 2024, I found myself at the start line of the Twisted Branch 100K race in the Finger Lakes region of upstate New York. This was an ultra marathon, 62 miles of a different, more primal type of running. Runners camped out in a meadow that night before, woke up at 3 a.m. When the race began at 4, 2 hours before sunrise, we scurried off into the woods in a tight single file. 2 miles in, with 60 to go, my left foot crashed into a thick root and I tumbled forward. I braced myself with my hands and was lucky to emerge with just a scrape. The course passed lakes and circled horse pastures, gravel roads, rocky creeks, mountain vistas, and hills so steep you felt you could stretch your hands straight in front of you and touch the ground ahead. Mostly, though, we were grinding through narrow paths in the woods, trying not to lose track of the orange trail flakes. I started out racing the way I usually do, tracking my pace on my watch and methodically monitoring my heart rate. About 30 miles in, I realized that I had been running for more time than I'd ever run before, and I still had 32 miles to go. My legs hurt. My abdomen hurt. I felt dizzy. I had missed dinner the night before because I'd stayed at the office a little longer than I should have and forgot my sandwich in a mad dash to get on the bus to the campground. I'd slept less than 4 hours. I had plenty of good reasons to drop out. Instead, I paused for a second and turned off my heart rate monitor. Then I flipped my watch to a screen where I couldn't see my pace. I stopped worrying about everything I normally worry about, and instead tried to imagine that I was a young boy bounding through the forests of New England, where I grew up. I let go of my concerns about time, heart rate, and cadence. I didn't worry about how many miles had passed or how many there were to go. I felt lighter as I ran and less worried. Every now and then, my watch would beep to signal that another mile had passed. Every hour or so, I would cruise into an aid station and eat whatever I felt like eating. I just kept moving forward, and remarkably, I seemed to pick up speed. I started passing other runners. A bee stung my calf. I could feel blisters the size of grapes forming on my feet. I stubbed my toes more times than I can count and more violently than I'd ever done before. Now I'd run 42, 46, 50 miles. At mile 52, I felt a touch of sadness that I only had 10 more miles to go. It was beautiful to run these trails without the pressure of wanting to finish in a certain time or to hold on to a specific place. The race finishes on a steep descent down a mountain. The kind of terrain where I struggled. And that can be agony on shredded quad muscles. I could hear the party down at the finish line at Champlain Beach with Brian Adams blasting from the speakers. I sprinted across the last 100 meters of grass. I didn't even know my time or how many people finished ahead of me. But I knew I had learned an entirely new way to run. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal Review on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. We close today with this article entitled Confessions of an Unphotogenic Man. In photographs, I look like a raccoon dressed as Batman. At least my baby son knows how to pose. This is written by Dan Kagan-Kanz, who writes about science and culture. I'll often just tell it like it is. I'm a nice-looking guy. I have high cheekbones, sharp jaw, outstanding skin. The other day, an Eastern European woman working at the grocery store heard I was 37, shook her head and muttered, "What do you people eat in this country?" But you'll have to take my word for it, because my face comes with an asterisk. One that wouldn't have mattered in earlier days, but today is such a big deal that the summit's nearly the whole deal. I am extremely unphotogenic. I don't look good in pictures. I look like I was whacked over the head a couple days ago, and then the guy came back to give me another the moment the photographer pressed click. I have circles under my eyes, so big and dark I look like a raccoon dressed as Batman. I look dazed, glazed, and when I'm really trying to shine, crazed. This isn't just my account. I don't have face dysmorphia. In college, I was skipped for an entrance mural team because a girl reviewing the candidates found a photo of me online, slumping in huge khakis. "Huh," she said, "don't you get it? My friend Jake said he doesn't really look like that. It's really the opposite." Years later, a co-worker noticed a photo of me, paused, and said, voice full of surprise, "Wait, are you unphotogenic?" For most of my life, this hasn't mattered much. I'm shy. I don't have Instagram or TikTok. But now I have a one-year-old son. That's hefty lump. This hefty lump of cuteness who gets several dozen photos taken every day. And some of these photos have me in them because much of his day is spent in my arms trying to escape them. There he is, looking so dear, so charming, so excited. And there I am, looking like a human sleep disorder with several priors. I admit I get a little annoyed. I get sad, too, because, and I'm not exaggerating, everybody who ever meets us says this, "He looks exactly like me." when he was really small, and I was holding him in the middle of the night, and he was looking up at me, I would get the strangest, the most dizzying, doubled feeling. But going by our pictures, nobody would ever understand that. No, no, you say, I just need out to figure out my angles. I just need to loosen up. But I've tried. Most posing advice slides right off me. It's too unnatural to take. Smile with your eyes. But what if the call's even more attention to the raccoon? Be yourself on camera. But what is myself on camera? And what if it just looks like this? I know, because I look this way in candids, too. Lately, I've been thinking about embracing my problem and adopting the stiff, scowling 19th century portrait position. But that pairs even worse with a beaming kid. But besides, why should I have to do anything? It's unfair. My son doesn't have to figure out his angles. He's nothing but angles. We must accept that there's something with my face. I don't know how to arrange it. I don't know what to do with it. For the artificial eye. Apparently fate has decreed that I will go around looking to cameras, but not to humans, like I've just been stunned. CCTV footage of me must be a joke. FaceTime is impossible. Thank God my wife lived nearby when we met, because I would never have dated anyone long distance. It wouldn't have lasted more than a week. I've had to send Jake to plead my case. Just try to remember. He looks way better in real life. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 2nd issue of the Wall Street Journal Review. We read from the Wall Street Journal Review every Thursday at 7 p.m. Your reader tonight has been Don Swans. Thank you for listening. I truly mean that. I enjoy being here with you. And hope, certainly, that next week you'll be here, same time, same place, on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the New York Times. Following that at 9 o'clock is Fortune Magazine, and at 10 o'clock is episode number 1 of Not Quite Dead Yet, by Holly Jackson, sorry. And stay with us. Holy cow! It's almost time for the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service Meat Raffle. It's Friday, November 7th at the Main Transit Fire Hall in Williamsville. Doors will open at 6 p.m. First spin will take place at 7 p.m. Admission is only $100 pre-sale and for veterans. $15 at the door, a table of 12 for only $100. You can purchase tickets by visiting www.nfradioreading.org or calling 716-821-5555.
Meat raffles are a great Western New York tradition. Come to ours and you'll be supporting your radio reading service.
The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,